A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging these arts organizations. Today, we'll get a preview of two upcoming performances that tie into themes of the forces and trends that shaped some of our cities. Golden Motors, a work about the impact of the auto industry on Detroit, will be staged next week at Brooklyn's Brickhouse Artist Studio, and I'll speak with composer Derek Vermeil and librettist Wendy S. Walters about the piece. The Annenberg Center in Philadelphia wraps up its series examining the role of migration in the city's history, and I'll chat with the center's executive and artistic director, Chris Gruitz. As always, let's start off today's program with a look at some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. Management and the musicians of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra appear no closer to reaching a new contract agreement as the players strike past the one-month milestone following their rejection of the latest offer. The Chicago Tribune reported that members of the Chicago's union voted April 8th on the proposal, which would have offered annual salary increases and phase-in changes to the pension program. According to the Tribune, the musicians felt the increases were not enough to stay competitive with other orchestras and objected to the overall changes in the pension system. Concerts have been canceled through April 24th, including the orchestra's own concerts and those of touring symphonies, and the Tribune said both sides are hoping to be able to salvage at least part of the rest of the season. The musicians launched their strike on March 10th. A bel canto soprano who runs marathons has been named as the 2019 recipient of the Richard Tucker Award. The Richard Tucker Music Foundation announced Lizette Oropeza, a graduate of Louisiana State University, as this year's winner. She is a past winner of the Metropolitan Opera National Council auditions and sang the role of Susanna at the Met, her professional debut in a principal role in 2007 at the age of 22. Oropeza is a native of Baton Rouge and, according to her website, has completed 6 marathons. She's also appeared on stage with the San Francisco Opera, Los Angeles Opera, Opera Philadelphia, and Washington National Opera, and sung in concert with the Philadelphia Orchestra, Royal Concertgebouw, and Chicago Symphony Orchestra. The award comes with a $50,000 purse and is given to an American singer on the verge of a major national and international career. Past recipients have included Joyce DiDonato, Christine Gurka, Deborah Voigt, and Renee Fleming. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world.
Even now, she can see there's no magic up my sleeve. No thunderbolt, no lightning rod. I'm not scary. This little girl turn around my empty world.
Only God in the shape of a
Social and economic issues are now frequently front and center when artists create new works or programming, and my guests this week reflect two examples of this. In Brooklyn, composer Derek Vermeil and librettist Wendy S. Walters will present the debut of select scenes of their opera musical theater work in progress, Golden Motors, at Brick House. The work is set in Detroit, weaving a story from the experiences of those whose livelihoods depend in large part on the auto industry. Also coming up next week is a performance of Handel's Semele by the English Concert at the Annenberg Center in Philadelphia. The performance caps off the center series The Philadelphians, which has presented concerts highlighting the influence of some of the immigrants and migrants on the city's early cultural and musical life. We'll start off with my conversation with Vermeil and Walters, who have collaborated frequently on other works in the past, going back more than a quarter century when they were studying together in Michigan. This particular work centered on the story that Walters said she was eager to tell.
Well, I grew up outside of Detroit, and my father worked for the auto industry most of my life. And the stories that are in the show are, you know, based on the kinds of stories that I heard growing up. So there, you know, certainly were challenges in our community as, you know, people's jobs disappeared, different kinds of pressures on family. And that really shaped what I understood to be the family life experience at the time.
Well, what are some of the stories and some of the themes of the stories that are woven in through this?
Some of the stories that are woven into this are, you know, the story of what it really means to work. What does it mean to define yourself by your job? And what happens when your job is taken away or when you can no longer perform your job? How do you define yourself in terms of your role in the family? We have a father who is a security guard, and there's a violent incident at the beginning of the show that kind of sends his whole career trajectory into a lurch. And it ends up redefining who he thinks of as himself, and it also ends up redefining his relationship with his daughter. Maybe one of the central questions of the piece is, what is one's work's relationship to one's identity or one's purpose in life?
And how were you able then to bring, you know, use the music and the lyrics to bring that out, to bring some of the to underscore that? And in particular, how does the music kind of tell the story as well?
Well, Detroit is an incredibly musical town. Anybody who's spent time there knows it has an amazing jazz scene, still does today and has for a long time. And also R&B really developed there, kind of came of age in the Motown era. And so there's so many different musical facets to the city itself. And, you know, we felt like we could tell a lot through music and through movement on stage in a way that you can't with a story, you know, that's just being told theatrically. So there's a lot of different types of music. There's a lot of music coming out of Black music, like, you know, from R&B, but also things that sound jazzier, things that sound more like early rock and roll or like, but then there are influences from outside of that, like from even more kind of Irish music even, or other types of music that just feel like they were resonant with the lyrics. And I would just say, you know, Wendy's a great, great lyricist. And so her lyrics, I mean, all different directions musically. So it's really exciting to try to find all the different touchstones for what her lyrics set up musically. And that's what's been exciting is to tell the story through music in many, many different directions. You know, there are work songs. There are kind of pensive songs. There are really dramatic songs. And then, you know, it goes, when I say the word song, I mean, it's kind of hard because this is a piece that sits somewhere between music theater and opera. And so we try to maybe not use the word aria, but there's certainly aria in the piece too.
His musical vocabulary is informed by, you know, an ear that is really open to global music. And yet I think he also has an incredible understanding of American popular song and American music and kind of the history of musical traditions in the U.S. that have arisen out of communities that have faced social and political challenges. So, you know, it's also just incredible fun for me to work with him because his musical palette is so broad. And yet, I think both of us can point to, you know, the library of African-American music as being kind of fundamental to our own artistic development, to the early stages of our own artistic development, you know, for him in music, but for me in literature. And so, you know, it's one of the places where we find our creative interest intersecting, you know, again and again. And as you said, we've worked together for a really long time. So sometimes it's hard to describe the way that we work other than for me, it's, you know, just work that I really enjoy. You know, I just really enjoy having the opportunity to collaborate with someone whose openness and vision I really trust, and to be in dialogue with him in pieces as they move in kind of unexpected directions.
Well, I understand one of the works on which you've collaborated in the past was The Good Life, which looked at the history in some ways in a similar light of Pittsburgh. What have you found satisfying or attractive about being able to use music and the libretto of the operas and these types of works to tell a city or a region's story or that of its people?
I mean, there's something so spectacular about the human voice and all manifestations. And when you have access to a chorus, it reminds me of the populace. It's the citizenry. It's Whitman's vision of America, of, you know, everybody in some ways contributing to the broader sound of the emergent nation. And, you know, one could say that we're still emerging. We're still trying to figure out what we mean as a nation. So, you know, working on The Good Life was incredible because we had the Mendelssohn Choir, 200 voices joining in with a huge orchestra. And, you know, an orchestra is not a democratic organism, but it's a very organized system. And that organization lends to a kind of hospitality and invitation to a broad audience that just really can't be matched by any other technology. So for me, that's what, you know, that's what's so exciting about it.
Yeah, I've realized that in the past few years, I've done a lot of pieces that deal with a particular city or a particular kind of movement, social movement, and maybe telling stories, being interested in telling stories that are not the ones in the history books necessarily, stories that actually are very important to our national history and to an understanding of what it means to be American, just what Wendy was saying, but maybe not the typical story that we read about in our history book. So maybe these are the unspoken stories or the unarticulated stories that art can attempt to tell. I don't mean art like some dude, but art, you know, in the larger sense. But that we can, you know, that we can kind of reach deeper to try to unearth stories and to tell stories that might be uncomfortable to tell or might be unknown to most people. That's really exciting to me because it makes me feel like the art also has this social thread that goes along with it. I'm not necessarily a huge fan of art being didactic or trying to tell you what to think or being so overtly political, but I think that if it can fill in the gaps and if it can spur dialogue and it can make people think and give them agency to think about things that they might not have been inclined to think about before, then it's served a very important role in society too.
Now, this was done as part of your residency at Brick Lab. What has that experience provided you?
You know, it's really amazing. The whole Brick organization is rooted in the Brooklyn community, but it really has a global reach and its understanding of Brooklyn as a global community. So the caliber of artwork that is done here is really stunning. So it's quite an honor to be included in their programming, you know, their programming list for this year. And, you know, there's a real understanding of the arts moving from not just theatrical disciplines, but into music, into object making, into collaborative processes in the community, into arts education, into television, broadcast, film. So we are just now starting our physical residency here, but along the year we've been able to come to Brick, you know, to experience other kinds of creative examples that they're celebrating and hosting. And it just really is, to me, it's a very distinctly rooted space in its both community focus, but in its broad reach artistically.
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel similarly, and I live in Brooklyn, so it's a quick ride on the train. But in all seriousness, I think they're a very important organization in Brooklyn, and you can see it in the diversity of work that they produce and diversity of artists that they're interested in. So, yeah, it's really a pleasure to be here.
I understand also that this work had readings both Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton and also in Portland, Oregon. What type of response and feedback did you get from those readings?
You know, we've been really lucky to have a very enthusiastic response to the pieces when we've performed them. Though I have to say that one of the opportunities that Brick is giving us is to actually stage the piece. So we've done readings, essentially readings of the work at the two places that you mentioned. The show as a whole is so large, with something like 31 musical numbers and two full acts, that in the time that we've been able to do the work previously, we just really haven't had enough time to do the musical work, the whole show, and then actually get it on its feet. So with this residency, we are doing a much smaller section of the show, but we are involving our director, Johanna McKeon, is also working with choreographer Kyle Marshall, who is really bringing the actors into the physical relationship with the music and with the story in a way that we haven't seen before. So it's very encouraging to see those elements of the story be really present in a way that we haven't been able to do before.
Do you have plans for a full staging in the near future, or is that still a work in progress?
Well, part of what Brick Lab does is they have presentations, public presentations. So ours will be on the 18th and 19th next week, and end of next week. And the idea is to stage this for people. And they invite people, we invite people, and we invite your audience if you want to come. The idea is that, you know, folks in the industry will get to see the piece, and hopefully that'll spur some interest for a full production. And, I know that that's one of the things that Brick does well, is connect you with folks in the industry, and you work toward that goal. So that's what we're doing this week. We're working to do this presentation, which will be staged with lighting and dance and costumes and the music. So so it's exciting to be working toward this goal as well.
You know, one of the opportunities but also challenges with this piece is that it's not based on an existing play. It's not a revival. It's not a translation of a classical story into a contemporary story. And it's not a jukebox musical. So new opera or new musical theater, new works that have song involved in them are in some ways very rare to see. It's not a translation of a movie into a musical. And so much of, you know, what is broadly available are works that are based on a previous work. So we feel really lucky that we're having this opportunity to show it. And for your audience, you know, this would be an opportunity to see a work that they wouldn't necessarily be able to see in another incarnation elsewhere.
That was my conversation with composer Derek Bermel and librettist Wendy S. Walters. Selected scenes from their work in progress, Golden Mothers, will debut in New York this Thursday and Friday, April 18th and 19th, at Brickhouse Artist Studio in Brooklyn. More information is available at brickartsmedia.org, with Brick spelled B-R-I-C. The Philadelphians series at the Annenberg Center, subtitled Migrations That Made Our City, has focused on Philadelphia's colonial-era music scene. But that has gone beyond the European traditions of Handel, Bach, and Vivaldi. The concerts have also brought in music influenced by the experience of African-American slaves. Chris Gruitz is the center's executive and artistic director, and I spoke with him about the upcoming performance and what other traditions the series has allowed audiences to explore.
Well, a lot of what we were trying to bring together for audiences in Philadelphia was a look back at the migrations of people that really built the city. And so we've started with two major populations, one being immigrants from Europe, so colonial Philadelphians who came over here and settled the city, as well as forced migrations of people, and in particular, enslaved Africans who were brought over here against their will. And we wanted to look at both of these populations through the lens of the performing arts, to really see what type of musical life and cultural life they would have brought with them to this frontier city, which really at that time was a frontier city. And we're doing this really as an exercise to really, in a way, celebrate and also remind everyone of the great migrations of peoples that have built our city and our country. And we felt it was a topical issue right now, and one that we wanted to really take a look at through the lens of the performing arts.
Well, let's look at the one that's coming up. Tell us a bit about the performance with the English Concert and how that fits in kind of as a capstone to this series.
Well, a lot of our research had us over at the Penn Libraries, and the Penn Libraries have a really fantastic collection by Francis Hopkinson, an early Philadelphian, and he really had one of the earliest sheet music collections in America, and in particular in Philadelphia. And he was sending away for a lot of sheet music from Europe at the time, and then holding salon-style performances in his home in Philadelphia for kind of a range of amateur musicians and Philadelphians who played. So Handel would have been known to Philadelphians who were interested in music. He was a superstar of the day, of the mid-18th century, the most popular by far opera composer. And though German, we associate him now as a British composer or English composer, even though he was German, but was in London and really was taking the city by storm. So Philadelphians would have been aware of his music. In fact, Ben Franklin was at his last public performance, and Ben Franklin didn't really care for his music. He felt that it was too ornamented and not honest and true folk song, which he liked to refer to. But he was such a wildly popular composer, and we felt he was a great example of the type of music that Philadelphians would have been aware of, but wouldn't have necessarily had the chance to see in person. So in association with this performance, there's a pop-up exhibition at the Penn Libraries from the Hopkinson Collection. Last night, we just did a Junto discussion at the Library Company with their director and interested audience members to talk about early cultural life in Philadelphia. And we wanted to really look at Handel's work, and Semele in particular, because it was really conceived as an oratorio, kind of an opera in disguise, if you will. And the English Concert's really just such a phenomenal group, one of the finest in the world for this type of music. And they hadn't been to Philadelphia before, so we thought this was a great opportunity to bring a really outstanding ensemble with an outstanding cast to perform some very special music.
Tell us a bit about some of the other concerts that took place as part of this series. In particular, there was one looking at the music of African-American experience with Jordi Savall.
That's right. So in the fall, we kind of kicked off the series with Jordi Savall, and he's another artist that had not been to Philadelphia before, which is kind of hard to believe. But we were really thrilled to present his Philadelphia debut in a program that he had called The Routes of Slavery. And this was really a program that brought together artists from Latin America, from Africa, from Europe, to really look at how enslaved people forged a sense of community and found a way to get through this unfortunate experience. And so he really pulled together a lot of different music from the slave period right up through kind of the colonization of the New World. And it turned out to be just a remarkable performance of early music, world music, of music, African music, music from colonial Spain and Latin America. And it was a really tremendous, very unique program. And it started this series because we really wanted to look at, you know, so many people who came to North America didn't have a choice when they were coming here. They were forced to come here. And that's a very different experience than a voluntary migration to a new place. And so we wanted to look at what they brought with them culturally and how, in many cases, this music, this dance, really was a way for them to hold on to the culture they were forced to leave behind, which is an entirely different experience from the migrations of people who came here voluntarily and were looking back to Europe for a lot of their culture.
What type of response did you get from the attendees?
People were really blown away. I can tell you quite honestly, we present so many different programs and performances, and I am really at most of them. But this was a very special evening. The performance with Jordi Savall and the ensemble, you know, there was 50 musicians from so many different countries. I think there was at least 30 countries represented. So I think everybody in the audience felt that energy. They felt that they were part of something very unique and very different. And to really look at that topic through the lens of this early repertoire and early performance was a really special opportunity.
Now, did you feel that you were able to reach new people through this series, or perhaps provide some of your regular audience members with a new way to look at the broader world of classical and world music?
I think so. I think there's two things at play here. The first is that Philadelphia really hasn't had a series in a very long time that has been bringing in national and international ensembles in early music. So that's the first thing. There's a great early music audience here. There's phenomenal groups like Tempesta de Mare in Philadelphia or Pifaro. So nationally known local groups that have a good following. But there hasn't really been a presenter or a center that's been bringing in groups of international stature. They've been performing in New York and then skipping Philadelphia and going on to D.C. So I think we captured a lot of audience who were interested in these ensembles and the type of repertoire they perform and hadn't had an opportunity to see them, certainly within the last 10 years. So there's definitely that audience, that kind of core classical and early music audience. But we also found through a lot of these programs that there was a lot of people interested in world music and interested in this topic, curious about the history of Philadelphia, Philadelphia's cultural history, and what type of music early populations were engaged with. And so we found a very different type of audience to some of these performances than you would associate with a typical Baroque or early music audience. And so far it's been a real success in terms of audience engagement.
And how did the other concerts also reflect this combination of looking at the migration and immigrant impact with tying in the early music?
Well, the series really went across a couple different disciplines. So we had a world premiere and commission of a piece entitled Vessels, which was based on a group of artists from New Orleans who went to West Africa and studied West African song and dance. And this was a performance art piece and a new work, so very much in the vein of contemporary performance. But it was really informed by their research at early West African song and dance. And that was a very different type of experience. It was theater and contemporary performance that really drew on this idea of early song and dance from this region of the world. And so we saw a very diverse audience. We saw an audience full of younger people, of older people, people who really represented Philadelphia across the full spectrum. So it was really exciting to see. I think we're going to see an interesting audience next week at Semele. I think people are so thrilled to be seeing this group in Philadelphia for the first time. This is a very popular composer, as you know. Handel is tremendously popular today. What struck me, I looked on Spotify the other day, and Handel still today commands about 1.4 million listeners a month on that platform alone, which I think is pretty tremendous for a composer who was wildly popular in the 18th century.
That was Chris Gruitz, Executive and Artistic Director of the Annenberg Center in Philadelphia. The English concert will perform Handel's Semele at the center Tuesday, April 16th. You can find the details at annenbergcenter.org. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you each week on A Tempo, focusing on the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for your support of the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. You can listen to past programs of A Tempo by going to our arts and cultural news page at wwfm.org or searching for A Tempo on our program page. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.